I'm betting you're awake. Are you?
What do you want?
Figured I'd like to talk to you.
About what?
A little conversation.
Pick up that phone and speak the words.
There's a caller who's sure.
Hello?
Bradley J is too bold.
Hello?
And he's dying to call and get even.
Hello?
When he's on air, he knows.
Hello?
Bradley's mind's never closed.
Hello?
With a word, he can get what he came for.
Jay Talking with Bradley J.
Call him.
Oh, stewardess, I speak Jay.
WBC News Radio 1030.
WBC, 34 degrees. It's cold. Really, you need gloves. It's the first day where I said, oh, should have had gloves. I'll get you the full weather at the bottom of the hour. Bradley J, you are Jay Talking. Andrew is our producer tonight. And you know that I talk about religion a lot. I'm curious about it. I mean, what could be more important? It's about the very basis of everything we believe, how we live our lives, what happens after that life is over. It's massively important. And there's a lot of ignorance about religion and religions. And I possess much of that ignorance, but I'm going to try to do something about that. So I talked to my booker, the booker of the program, and what we're going to do is invite members of various religions to learn about them. Because ignorance breeds hate. People are afraid of what they don't know. And that's why travel's good. I do like to go in other countries and talk to people who do things differently. And it's important. Now, a lot of you can't travel, but I'm gonna bring the different people to you. And towards that end, we have Indapreet Singh. How do you do, sir?
Good. How are you?
Indapreet is a Sikh. And I think I chose you first because we talk about Islam a lot. And you get, there's ignorance involved. You get confused with Muslims. So I wanted to make that distinction first. So let me ask you the very broad question. Indapreet, who are you? And you define that as you want.
Okay. First of all, glad to be here. And really, I think you hit the nail on the head about, you know, ignorance is the one that breeds hate. And, you know, learning from each other is where we can change that to love. And I believe it or not, I mean, I didn't think to start this way, but one of the pieces of my name, one of the words, Indapreet, Preet means love. So, and you know, Sikh names are usually different words from our scriptures, and the scriptures, are, like all religions, is about peace and love. But who am I? I'm just a regular kind of guy, but I'm a practitioner of the Sikh faith. I live here in Massachusetts. I've been here about in the United States about 30 years. Went to school here in Worcester, and born in India originally, but most of my life I've been outside of India. Now, you know, it's not about my life history, although my Sikhi, my faith and my life history is quite intertwined. I have a family, two beautiful daughters, beautiful wife. Mom and dad are also here in America with me. You know, a lot of extended family.
Do you get back to India often?
Occasionally. My wife is from India, so, you know, to visit. And my grandma is still in India.
Towards the end of the program, I guess I'd like to talk to you about India.
Okay, sure.
I have a lot of questions about that.
Sure.
Now, can you help us understand what Sikhi is? Did I say
right.
it correctly?
Yeah.
Sikhi. Okay.
Yeah, I call it Sikhi.
You can say ism, but Sikhi is
Sikhi is our preferred way to refer to the faith. Sikhism is what it's commonly known as, and it is it's referred to as Sikh or Sikhi, but commonly in the West, Sikh is what it is,
okay.
is usually said. But so, what is Sikhi? I mean, that is a very broad question, and if to By the way, I'm also part of an organization that, you know, kind of works towards the education, sick education of our community here in North America. And you have to start the explanation of Sikhi in kind of three aspects. What is the divine in Sikhi? How does one realize that divine? And then the Sikhs themselves, the people. So the divinity, the guru in our case, the ones that help us realize divinity is called the guru, and the people themselves.
All right. So the parallel is the god, the priest, the parishioners. It's not the same, but it's the kind of, there are three groups. The divinity in both cases, the people that are the middle people and teach you and help you get to the divinity, and you.
Right. But in our case, the people that help us get to divinity are not intermediaries. They are the catalyst to help us realize that the divine is within us.
So can you get to your divine without the middle people? Because in some religions, you can't.
Understood.
How about Sikhi?
Yeah, and in our case, I would opine that the guru is not the middleman. Again, the guru is wisdom. One of the fundamental beliefs that we have is the word guru is made up of two words, gu and ru. Gu meaning darkness, ru meaning light. So the one who takes you from darkness to light, and in the South Indian context, light means wisdom.
Is that right? Right. That
so
little bit
Leitner.
Of knowledge, that little bit of knowledge right there was worth the price of admission. That was awesome. That is great.
Yeah.
Okay. So your guru is not a turnstile through which you must pass to the divinity.
Absolutely.
The guru helps you get.
Guru is the music that you hear from that turnstile.
Okay.
Maybe. I just made that up, but that's one way to.
It's the help person to get you there.
Exactly.
Because you're kind of ignorant. They have studied. They know what's up, and they enlighten you.
And the Sikhs don't believe not only did they study, but they were realized. They were, if one has this mission in life to, you know, become one with the divine, if someone wants to, you know, say, I want to become one with God.
Right.
When you ask regular Sikhs, they'll say, what's the goal in life? Is to become one with God, right? But our scriptures present, you never were separate from God. You are an essence of the divine light. But the point is that the guru is not only the one who has studied, is the one who has also experienced divinity. So when you learn from someone who has experienced divine, and their words are presented as their experience of the love of the divine, that's what then inspires you to also love the divine.
How have they experienced the divine any more than you? How do they experience the divine?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So me as an individual, Inderpreet, would love to experience the divine just like Guru Nanak, who was our founding guru. Like many faiths, I guess, but we have a episode in the life of Guru Nanak. Guru Nanak was in the time frame of 1469. Just for context, 1492 is when Columbus, came to the shores over here in America. But around 1499, it says in our history that Guru Nanak had, you know, an encounter with the divine, and he as from a young age was that spiritual, active, kind of go against the grain of the norms of society of his day. So it wasn't that he, you know, got self-realized on a particular episode of his life, but there is a distinct a time in his life when, after which, he starts spreading his message of what is the very first word or actually it's a numeral of our scripture, of our, which, by the way, even our scripture we call guru because it's the words of the gurus, and that is Ik Onkar. And
what does that mean?
Very, very often translated as there is one God or one God. But God again has a particular connotation. It could be one universal force, one divine force, but the numeral one is actually used to start off 1,429 pages of divine-inspired poetic form of experiences from Guru Nanak. We had a series of 10 gurus, but six of the gurus have contributed to this anthology of divine poetry. In addition to that, about 15 different saints of various faith systems of that time frame and prior to Guru Nanak as well. So he collected inspirational, revealed poetry of the saints of the time. Again, the region, by saying that I was born in India, mm-hmm. you can conclude that it was in what we know today as Pakistan and India. There's a region called Punjab. It's a state in India, as well as a state in Pakistan. The state is called Punjab, and it means land of five rivers. Guru Nanak was born there. And subsequent gurus came from that similar vicinity. So the history of the gurus, their divine revelations, what we believe, which is now inscribed in what we call the Guru Granth Sahib, that really defines what Sikhi is, and it is essentially an experience of the Ik Onkar. Everything after the first numeral and the first word is kind of a description of what is Ik Onkar, mm-hmm. what is divine.
Well, that's what I want to get to. And by the way, the overriding thing of this whole series is to try to get at whether each religion is a different kind of version of the same basic model, or whether it's not. The purpose of religion is to take the blank slate of the human being and help them be good. And in order to do that, you have to understand what good is. And therefore, you have the guru, and you have to be taught what good is. And in the Sikh religion, you talked about, during that break, and I think it's key to what we're talking about, death of the consciousness. Maybe you could remember that thing you said. You probably say it a bunch. Say it again.
Yeah, well, this phrase that I just said is actually from a great Sikh of the modern times. But it's the fragrance of that comes from our Guru Granth Sahib, which is the scripture. And it's the physical death we should fear not.
Yep.
It is death of conscience that we must fear.
Okay.
And so it is...
Death of conscience.
Conscience.
Meaning death of trying to be good.
Or death of, if when I am put witness to, should I go this way or that way, the way of the righteous way is the mm-hmm. one that I, if I give up on righteousness.
Ah, so right? The death of conscience is to not care what path you take.
Right.
Okay, you want to care and you want to learn which is the right path. Now, in 1699... something happened.
Correct, yes.
This is key to what we're talking about.
Exactly, yeah. So 1469, first guru, continued on with a succession of nine gurus after that, our 10th guru, known as Guru Gobind Singh. He collects all the community. He sends out what we call hukamnama, basically invitation to the community, let's collect on a particular day in a city of bliss called the city of Anandpur. One of the unique things I do want to share, gurus in the Sikh faith are not just spiritualists, right, and divine beings. They are also city creators. They are civil engineers. They are art masters, etc. So the first guru also established a city called Kartarpur, city of the divine. These are names that, mm-hmm. translations I'm going to use. So Anandpur Sahib, the city of bliss, was where the ninth guru had established. His son, the tenth guru, collects everyone there and asks in a crowd, as it goes in our, bosom-to-bosom stories coming from generations, that he asked for five heads from the congregation. And there were thousands, 20 to 30,000, some say 80,000. Point is, he asked for who is willing to give up their life for the faith.
Right.
And six, who had never met the guru before, but who were descendants of those that had met Guru Nanak from different parts of the Indian subcontinent, mm-hmm. who had gathered, they came up. And because for them, they felt, and another fundamental precept of our faith is that the guru's divine light or wisdom is the same, just the bodies were different. So there was no distinction between the first guru and the 10th guru.
No, the first guru was 1469, and then were they descended from like son, father, son?
Another very important point. In South Asian traditions, it is usually the eldest son.
Okay.
The guru broke that tradition, and he chose the most worthy disciple. It so happened that by the time I think about the fourth guru, it became within the family, but it was never the...
That wasn't always the reason. That was just a coincidence.
Correct. Exactly.
All right. So the guru number one learns and studies, and each successive guru builds upon the knowledge of the... Then you get to the 10th guru. Basically, after 10 generations, it's figured out. And he calls a big gathering and asks for five people to give their lives to this. Okay, we're getting the big picture here. And five step forward, and what happens?
And he brings them out of the tent. So he comes with a sword, you know, dripping with blood, and the whole congregation is, the guru's gone mad. Something's really, really wrong here. How can he be sacrificing humans? But coming out of the tent are well-clad, what we call saint soldiers, dressed in, you know, full kind of the glory of, you know, the kind of clothes we used to wear at that time. And he says, these are the five lovers, the panch pyare, the five beloved ones. They have shown that, you know, that they would choose the righteous path when asked to do so, and not worry about the consequence of what others may think about that. He then does another fascinating thing, and I think in the, you know, history of different faiths, is that he asks, and he goes through an initiation ceremony of the five, right? And he says, now you, the five, are my guru, and I am your disciple. So this idea of servant leader model that is used in a lot of MBA schools nowadays,
yeah,
the guru chela, a guru disciple, enlightener disciple, he asked to be initiated by them. And to this day now, our guru, the guru is the community of committed Sikhs. The community is called the Khalsa community. So you
hear about a single person to a committee.
To a community.
Community.
Absolutely. The committee idea would be, and this is...
it'd be too arbitrary.
Prevalent in South Asian traditions is this idea of panch or five or panch.
Yeah.
That is an idea of a leadership committee. Huh. But in our case, in the Sikh faith, it's the holistic, maybe another word might be a commonwealth, the Khalsa commonwealth.
Okay.
All across, doesn't matter if you're from India or Punjab, even here in America, even in England, where Sikhs have migrated and are flourishing, the consciousness of the Khalsa, the community together, along with the Guru Granth Sahib, they make our present-day guru. So eternal guruship after the 10 human body gurus, you know, yep, the succession, was basically stopped in 1708 with the passing of our 10th guru, Guru Gobind Singh. And the scripture, the divine wisdom, plus the collective community who must make decisions for the community,
right,
based on the teachings in the Guru Granth Sahib, is the guru henceforth. That's what happened in 1699 up to 1708.
In Christianity, you go to church and they tell you which is the right path. They tell you how to act. We have the Ten Commandments, for one thing. How does it go for a Sikh? What is the right path, and how is it transmitted to people? If I were to go to your house of worship, what would I experience?
All right. We'll get to our house of worship later.
Sure.
Just the idea of right path. I'm inspired to share, and I'll answer it in two ways.
Okay.
One is a story of Guru Nanak, you know, because the question is perennial. What is the right path?
Right. I mean, that is the perennial question of every religion.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. And Guru Nanak used to get asked that all the time.
So how should I act?
So
what should I do?
Well, no. So you should got to understand in that time frame in South in India, on the coming from the west are the invaders from Persia and, you know, Turkey. on the eastern side are the established Hindu denominations and the yogis. Buddhism was already in place as
well.
What
do the Persians bring? What religion are they bringing with
Islam.
Them? Okay.
Islam. So it's like the perennial class of civilizations that happen in every region of the world. It was happening in that region at that time between Islam and Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Guru Nanak traveled a lot, and he is known to have even gone to Mecca. And engage with, he said he's in pursuit of those that are the learned ones. So, and he used to carry book, whatever he sang and revealed, he used to write it down. So the hajis, so the saying goes, asked him, Baba Nanak or Guru Nanak, open that book and tell us which is better, the Hindu or the Muslim.
Okay.
And so which is the right path?
Yeah.
Right? And he says, without good deeds, both are doomed. He's saying the right path is the one who does good deeds.
Right.
Right? And that was his simple message. What the prescription is of what is good deeds, that comes from understanding your origin, O human. Your origin is divinity, is the divine light. So what would be attributes of the divine should be the motivation for the actions you perform in your life.
All right. I mean, then what are the attributes of the divine? So at the end of the day, don't you get to do unto others as you would have them do unto you?
That's also another.
Isn't that it?
But that's, I think, from Guru Nanak's perspective, and that's kind of doing it for want of an expectation. Do things selflessly.
Well,
this idea of service.
Do you think really that the golden rule is not altruistic? Because that sounds like what you said. That sounds like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's not that you want them to do it unto you right away. It's
correct. No,
I'm just
no.
acting in a manner in which if the situation were reversed, I would want them to do the same thing.
Correct.
So don't all roads lead there?
Right. What the Sikh perspective would be is as long as the road is the road of love, absolutely all roads lead there. And there is no exclusive road. There is no exclusive expression of love for the creator.
No exclusive road, but a destination, a common destination.
Yes, and the common destination, again, is that ikonkar.
Okay.
That all-pervasive love, whether you call it omniscient, omnipresent, all of the, kind of divine words that one would use.
Right.
We have words for our divine that are permanent, timeless, all steel, all strong, all strength. But, there's other words as caretaker of the world, caretaker of the universes, right? So if these are divine attributes, a human must be... taking care of the world. Human must be strong. A human must be, helpful and gracious. All of those kind of things.
One thing that's important, audience, is not only to hear what Indrapreet says, but how he says it and the way he arrives at it. That's part of the in a way, the medium is the message. It's important to listen to the whole package. Okay. Say you've invited me to your house of worship. What would I? Am I allowed to go? By the way,
absolutely.
Anybody can go.
Fundamental precept of the Sikh faith is because God is one, all of God's creation are one, and there is no discrimination or equality allowed. Actually,
mm-hmm. I've been to mosques a lot, but I've never been to a what do you call your house of worship?
Gurdwara.
A gurdwara.
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 Yeah. Yeah,
Gurdwara.
Gurudwara.
Oh,
if
okay.
You would hear it, but it's Gurdwara is kind of
okay. Guru, the way what's Dwara? House.
There's one interpretation is house, but it is also a verb. It's through the guru, dwar
okay.
of the guru.
So this is
it's
kind
also
of the portal to the guru.
Door of the guru.
All right.
Through the guru.
So and I go to the portal.
Every
what's going to happen?
Every aspect of our worship is a learning experience through the singing of the divine poetry within the Guru Granth Sahib. So what you will see in our Gurdwara is, first of all, very basic rules, dress modestly, no alcohol or tobacco in your possession.
No shorts?
Shorts are
seriously.
Occasionally allowed.
Okay, that's a serious question.
Yeah.
Because some places you can't do shorts.
Yes.
What about a hat? Head, how about that?
So head covered.
Head
and
covered.
No shoes within the what we call the Divan Hall. So the hall in which the learning and prayer occurs. No shoes and head cover.
I like that. And you do wear a head cover.
Yes.
Any head cover?
We
like a camouflage Tom Brady hat.
Again, one shouldn't, you know, accost you for doing that. But
they may
every house of worship will have in the corner, you know, like bandanas,
right?
Type of
or like
type
at a fancy club, a blue blazer.
No.
So a bandana works.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I am the bandana man. So
all right, then you know we'll have colorful ones.
All right, and now I have dressed properly, and do I sit or do we stand?
Yes. So in the Divan Hall, in like a palanquin or kind of an altar, will be the central. Everything we do is central to the Guru Granth Sahib. So the Guru Granth Sahib is respected. Another word for our guru, you know, in colloquials of that time and even today, we call Sacha Pacha, the true sovereign, the sovereign one. So what you would maybe see in scenes of South Asian royalty, like a canopy on top with a whisk and, you know, maybe silken covers. The Guru Granth Sahib, which is in the form of a book, is covered in these. And there are readings happening from the Guru Granth Sahib. But what you will hear maybe when you walk in is singing.
Okay.
So on the side, the center is the altar. On the side, there would be professional hymn singers, as we call them. We call it kirtaniya. But the congregation, there is no distinction of role for the male or the female.
Right.
So you will see in a gurdwara, kids, old, young, adults, male, female, participating actively within the what you know is called in the West service, mm-hmm. the service. Mm-hmm. Right? We could call it the Divan.
One thing that'd be interesting for another whole time is the music and how Western music structure is maybe different than the structure mm-hmm. of your music, because in the West there's pretty finite note structure, mm-hmm. and in other areas of the world there are more notes and they're slightly off.
Right.
So the whole scale is different. When I'm singing in your house of worship, is it the scales that I'm used to, or is it going to be sort of different with more majors and minors and more notes in between?
I'm not an expert at Western music.
Does it sound the same? Could I sing it?
I think with practice, anyone can sing anything. And
is it in English?
No. So it's the words that are written within the Guru Granth Sahib.
Uh-huh.
You would be interested to know that the whole Guru Granth Sahib, you know how you have chapters and an index? The Guru Granth Sahib does not have chapter numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The Guru Granth Sahib is structured around musical melodies called, South Asian systems called rags. I don't know if you're familiar with Indian classical music.
No.
But there are different rags which connotate a particular mood, a particular time of day, a particular season. The Guru Granth Sahib is structured, first of all, as divine-inspired poetry, but also divine music.
So rather than chapter and verse, it's laid out as rag, musically.
Yeah, it's rag. Shri is the first rag. Rag Jajavanti is the last rag. So it's about 32 rags with different sub-rags associated with it. So
it's pretty interesting.
Another separate 8-hour workshop probably.
Yeah.
On the musicology of what we call the Guru Granth Sahib, which is called Gurmat Sangeet.
So it turns out the musicology is important because your book is set out musically.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. So music is central to the mode of worship that you'll see. Sikhs will come bow down to the Guru Granth Sahib, occasionally, you know, an offering of money culturally, men sit on one side, women sit on the other. There are no chairs except for the elderly or those that may be handicapped. Everyone sits on the floor cross-legged,
mm-hmm.
crisscross applesauce kind of style.
Yep.
After the singing sessions are over, there is a concluding prayer where everyone stands up. So sit during the singing or sermon, maybe, you know, it's called katha, lectures on Sikh history or Sikh language or, you know, exposition, explanation of the singing that's going on. The prayer proper is at the conclusion. Everyone stands up. Again, bows to the Guru Granth Sahib. And then there is a reading of the day or order of the day. A random page from the Guru Granth Sahib is opened, and that's kind of the order. So royal courts used to have musicians, right? Minstrels singing praises.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our singing session is.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we open the Guru Granth Sahib at a random page and a random paragraph, that's the order from the sovereign, right? That's how a service would then conclude. And the most important part, which I love to share with others, and we have it kind of ingrained in our culture, there is food afterwards.
Uh-huh.
It's actually part and parcel of our service. It's called the langar. Again, another institution established by Guru Nanak. Back in his day, what you eat, how you eat, where you eat was very important. It was imposed on society. Guru Nanak shattered that. And by the time of like the fourth guru, if anyone wanted to meet with the guru, they were asked to go to the langar congregation, eat on the same level, whether you are a pauper, whether you are a king or an emperor, whether you are, you know, a different caste who were not allowed to eat together. Break away those shackles of confinement, of discrimination. Eat, then come and enjoy divine poetry, conversations about divinity, because even that was in the context of the other religious systems was confined to different hierarchy of society, that they were allowed to be the priests, the others were not allowed to even talk about spirituality. So food and langar in our gurdwaras till this day, since the time of Guru Nanak, is a essential part of our gurdwaras. And is constant food going on. Another essential part of our place of worship will be a place of shelter and refuge for anyone and anyone who may need it. So we have four gurdwaras here in the Massachusetts area, one in Everett, one in Medford, one in Milford, and one in Millis. And you ask, you're allowed to come? You're welcome to come.
There's nothing in Brighton. Okay. I'm going to have to drive. It's all right. So there's no parallel between the bread, the body of Christ, the wine, the blood of Christ. The food does not in any way represent anything like that for you guys. It's more of a part of the interchange of
spiritual interaction. That food that I mentioned, the langar, that's going on constantly. And, because of the constraints, like there is no Sunday or holy day for the Sikhs.
But interesting.
We've just accommodated to the Sunday of the Western and
you have
Christian
so
cultures.
So you do
in
Sunday
India,
only because that's when kind of nobody's working. It's been the day that's been set aside for worshiping.
Yeah, technically a gurdwara is 24/7.
No, no holy day.
There are
of the week.
No holy day of the week.
All right, we have to break.
Okay,
this is really great, and I have to say something before I forget it. The more I speak to you, and this is the first time we've done this. The more I speak to you, it seems like something that would be magnificent to do is for a year, be a Sikh. Then for a year.
Yeah.
I don't see how anyone can judge another religion unless you've lived it.
Experience it.
For a considerable amount of time. And then after 20 years of 1 year at a time, then come talk to me about which one's better and which
one's not.
There was
someone who did that. There was something online where someone did that and recorded their experience of the different faiths they did for. Maybe it wasn't a year, but at least for.
So I probably don't have that kind of time left in my life, but at least I can do is spend an hour with each. This is great.
And that's great. I like that.
Say that there was a pamphlet of what you get and what you have to do if you're going to be a Sikh. This is what you get. This is what your responsibilities are. This is the payoff. What would you say in the short version?
The responsibility of a Sikh, the destination for a Sikh is not any kind of heaven, any kind of paradise. It is to live the best of what is within us, which is, again, I come back to that divine qualities. And, you know, your question, mm-hmm. what are the divine qualities? Those are all enshrined within the Guru Granth Sahib. But there's two aspects that essentially every Sikh kind of would be required to do is Simran and Seva. Simran is this continuous remembrance, continuous connection with those divine qualities, trying to make them part of your being,
yeah.
but not just in isolation. You got to convert that into your actions, and that is seva, which is service. So service to humanity. You'll hear this, you'll read this, you can Google Sikhi, and you'll see this whole idea of seva and Simran.
Seva is the service. What's Simran again?
Simran is... occasionally translated as meditation.
Okay.
Translated as remembrance, divine remembrance. And so, that you do through the singing, through the recitation, right. through kind of...
Simran is the knowledge of and the remembrance of and the being aware of, and the sava is the action.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And what
Guru
do
you... Nanak had golden rules, right? Three, like all faiths. There were three, pillars of Sikhi.
Yep.
Nam Jap, and again, it's a kind of a continuation of Seva Simran. Nam Japna, Kirt Karni, and Vanchakna.
Right? Three rules.
Nam Japna is, again, very similar to what I just described Simran to be.
Yeah.
Be in constant remembrance and ever-present force of Ikonkar, right? That Ikonkar, the creator.
Yep.
Kirt Karni is to earn an honest living. The saying goes in India, and hopefully around here, you'll never see a Sikh be a beggar. You asked about responsibilities. Yep. The responsibility of a Sikh is to earn an honest living.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is Vanchakna. And fruits of that honest living is where you use that for service. And Vanchakna literally means to share. And it's to share the rewards rather than mere accumulation. There's no qualms about accumulating. We have great entrepreneurs who are millionaires, probably some billionaires.
Yep.
But the responsibility of Sikhs as a community and also as individuals is to share with those that are less fortunate. And that sharing with others that are less fortunate is not just in monetary. Also stand with those that are oppressed in any form, right? That kind of that whole idea of equality is mm-hmm. also within our being. So we should not practice that within our families, within our houses of worship, within our communities.
Mm-hmm.
We should not tolerate discrimination in our whatever is our sphere of control as well.
We don't have much time. Everlasting life, not part of your religion.
Everlasting
life. Well, in Christianity, you get to, if you're good, you get to live forever.
Oh, I see.
And not the case with there's Sikh religion?
The Sikh faith, I don't know if it's a similarity, but kind of like the goal. What is the goal? And in other South Asian faiths, there's this idea of mukti or freedom or, you know, kind of getting out of this cycle of birth and death.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned for Buddhism. Also in a lot. We have that idea, but you don't need physical death to achieve that freedom, liberation. There's an idea within our scriptures called Jivan Mukti, where it's liberation while living. This enlightenment, this recognition of the divine within you, if you hit that, and it can happen in an instant, it can happen in a process, that is enough of a liberation.
So once you become liberated, are you almost liberated from your body so that when your body dies, this enlightened, liberated being, soul, continues to live forever? After your body dies?
The live forever, as I've been taught and I've understood, is more like it's like a wave coming out of the ocean, right? That's our experience, our cycles of birth, but it then goes back into the ocean. So it's merging back into that infinite. You came from infinite, you go back into infinite.
So
whether it's living in a particular space.
So that takes care of the freaking out about ceasing to exist. You do continue to exist, only your soma slides back into the ocean and exists within the greater period.
Exactly.
All right.
The greater one being the Ikonkar.
Wow. We kind of covered a lot. One two-minute thing. Folks who don't know about you and what you wear confuse you with Muslims, and you have been the victim of violence due to ignorance. Is there? Can you address that in 60 seconds? And maybe even say, point out what the difference is between what you wear and what the Muslims' style of dress is?
Yeah. So, well,
people don't seem to be able to make the distinction in some cases.
Right. So you will see both men and women, by the way, wear turbans in the Sikh faith, majority being men. So all Sikhs who are practitioners are turban wearers, but not all turban wearers are necessarily Sikh. In the United States, probably 99% of those that wear a turban are Sikh.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a fundamental external distinction. However,
as opposed to the KF, is that how you say it? The cloth with the band around it, or some.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
different thing. Please go and look at the books and see the difference.
Yeah, but I do want to make sure it's very clear from as a Sikh.
Yep.
Whether there should be violence against a Muslim or someone who looks like the other, that's not the whole point here.
Right. Let's just not have violence against people who anybody at all.
Exactly.
Particularly for reasons because they seem different. So, we're out of time. We accomplished a lot, but we didn't accomplish it all. Maybe you'll even come back, would you?
I would love to. I think this is a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's WBZ.